I did change my shirt. I have toothpaste all over it right before.
What are you, like a sloppy toothbrusher?
Apparently so.
Is this a common problem? They're like, I have to wear an apron when I brush my teeth.
It is. I think it's just because I'm thorough.
Okay, sure. Welcome to Shiny Epi People. I'm Lisa Bodner. Today's episode marks 6 months since I released my first show with Carrie Keyes back in early August. Today is the 28th episode I've put out. This is wild and fun. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy the show and want to support it, go to my Patreon at patreon.com/shinyepipeople. I also post other content on Twitter and Instagram at shinyepipeople. Today, I'm speaking with Bill Miller. Bill is an infectious disease epidemiologist, and most of his research focuses on sexually transmitted infections, HIV, and substance use. Bill is professor in the Division of Epidemiology in the College of Public Health at The Ohio State University. He also serves as the Senior Associate Dean for Research. Bill is the editor-in-chief of the journal Sexually Transmitted Diseases and is an associate editor for Epidemiology. Bill received his MD and his PhD from Johns Hopkins. His PhD is in neuroscience, which he received several years before he figured out that really he was meant to be an epidemiologist. Bill served on faculty at UNC Chapel Hill for 19 years, that's where I met him, before he joined Ohio State. So with all the success and leadership Bill's had, it might surprise you that he asked me if he could talk today about his imposter syndrome and being an extreme introvert. If you're on Twitter, you know that Bill is funny, smart, and relatable. And what has drawn a lot of people to him is his willingness to be vulnerable and authentic. He shows all of these characteristics today. If you aren't on Twitter, you'll see why he is such a popular and warm presence in our field. I hope you enjoy this chat. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Lisa.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Do you remember roughly how we met?
No.
You were co-teaching, I guess, Epi 268 with Charlie Poole.
Oh, yeah. I was the lab instructor. I was complete imposter the whole time doing that.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Charlie's up there teaching, and I just finished my MPH like a year ago.
Oh, did you? Okay. Wow. Okay, let's dive into that right now. You described yourself to me as an introverted imposter with ADD. A lot of things there to unpack. And that your mom and siblings regularly referred to you as the dumbest smart kid they ever knew. So, where do we start, Bill?
Well, that's all true. Maybe we'll start with the ADD part. I was an active child. I played sports all the time, which was definitely good for me. And I was the kind of kid that if I had a chance to dive or slide, I would. My mom used to say that I brought half the infield dirt home with me after baseball games.
Yeah. Could she even like get the mud stains off your uniform? My mom used to be like, these are just permanent. Like I can't get them off.
Yeah. She would just give up.
Yeah.
We lived out in the country. We lived on the main road from the city of Binghamton to Pennsylvania. And they drove pretty fast on that road, even though it was a backcountry road. And one day I was just like bored, I guess, and decided to stand by the side of the road and figure out how early I had to throw little pebbles up into the air, like arc them to hit the car as it went by. Inquisitive minds.
Yeah.
I had no concept that it might be bad for the car.
Okay.
And then after a few failures, I succeeded on this big pickup truck. He was not happy. Oh. He just jammed on the brakes and like backed up and essentially picked me up by my collar and like carted me inside and asked my mother, like, how did you let your child do this? And she was like, I had no idea he was doing that.
Yeah.
Because the dumbest smart kid thing was like, I was doing something that was like an intelligent like endeavor.
Yes.
But
yes.
No thinking of the consequences that might be down the way.
Right.
But anyway, so I had no idea I had ADD really until my son was in junior high and we were having him evaluated for ADD. It was just so clear that what my son had was struggling with were things that I had struggled with and learned to manage in my own way.
So how do you manage it at work now?
Sometimes with a lot of difficulty. The most important things are to recognize that I can hyperfocus, which is a part of ADD, and that usually happens when I'm writing a grant. I can really get into it in that moment and stay there and stay focused.
In a bad way, or?
No, that's a good thing. That's okay. Like one of the benefits of having.
Okay. Those. So it's not like if someone's talking to you, you can't.
Oh, it is a little bit like that.
It is a little bit like that. Okay. Like, would your wife say, like, that can be annoying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, she's more annoyed by other aspects.
Let's get her on.
It took us several years for us to realize that when we were in a restaurant, as an example, that I had to sit with my back to the TV. If the TV was in front of me, it's almost impossible to not be looking. Sometimes when we're out, I just explicitly have to say, I'm sorry, I really can't focus. Things that happen related to it at work, and this happens to other people too, I'm sure, but you know, there are meetings when I just have to stand up and move. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to attempt to be able to concentrate, because it's sort of like the energy in my brain can be transferred to my body if I start moving some. There are times when I'm in a meeting, it's like an hour long meeting, you know, and I'll just have to say, I have to leave at 45 minutes because I can no longer manage to control that urge to move. When you knew me at UNC, I was in the state where I felt like I had to know everything. If someone talked about some method or something, and I would pretend like I knew what they what they were talking about, and then I would go figure it out without really telling anyone because I was afraid that people were going to figure out that I didn't know anything.
Yeah,
I spent like the first 5 or 6 years. In fear that people were going to discover that I really didn't know anything. And it took me a while to realize that if I admitted that I didn't know how to do something, no one was going to like throw me out. My imposterness, I think, goes back, probably really begins in college. I went to a little podunk high school. I think maybe a quarter or a third of my classmates went to college. Going from that to Princeton, where I went to college, like I was like, whoa.
Whoa.
There's a lot of smart people here. And do I actually belong here? Somehow I managed to make it through there and then went to Hopkins for medical school. And it was like double whoa.
Right.
Like I did fine. I always felt like I didn't quite belong. And then my training was such that I was so nonlinear in my pathway to where I got to that every step along the way, I felt like I didn't quite belong. You know, my PhD's in neuroscience.
When did your PhD happen relative to the MD?
Well, I did it in a weird way because I never did anything normal.
Yeah.
Applied to MD PhD programs, got into one or two, but got into Hopkins. So I was like, I should go to Hopkins. So I went to Hopkins for medicine. But then they started the neuroscience degree while I was there. And I was in the first class of the PhD for that. And so on the plus side of doing it that way is when I graduated with my medical school class. So I got paid as a postdoc
For
the rest of my PhD. The downside was that when I finished my PhD, I literally defended on a Wednesday and started my internship on Thursday.
Wow.
That contributed to the imposter as a clinician because I hadn't done anything clinical for 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah.
I've bounced back and forth between things enough that wherever I find myself, I always find myself sort of not really an expert in anything and thinking that I'm supposed to be and feeling like people think I'm supposed to be. The way I end up turning that around to talk to students and encourage people that many people are feel like they're imposters.
Absolutely. When people reach out to me and they say, you know, I want some advice, or I've read your paper and I think it's great, I almost always say, really?
Like, exactly.
I think I'm still 27 trying to get a K award.
I still feel very junior, even though like I have this like deanship thing, you know.
Right.
Who made that mistake?
Yeah.
I remember at UNC one time we were in our training program and we were sitting around this conference room and we brought up imposter syndrome. It was probably in the early 2000s and people hadn't really started talking about it that much, and went around the room and it was remarkable. Every single person felt like they were in that room by mistake.
Wow.
This one senior person came in another time and we sort of point blank asked him that question and he was like, what?
He was a white man, I assume?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And I just sort of was taken aback a little bit. Like, I can't imagine having that level of confidence.
Yeah.
It's just never been a part of me.
So how does the ADD tie in with the imposter syndrome and the introvertedness?
Being an introvert is probably one of the most defining characteristics of who I am. COVID, work from home, is like the best thing.
What was work like before that made it hard for you as an introvert?
Talking to people.
Just talking.
Yeah, like being around other people. I don't even have to talk to them. If I'm around them.
And what does it do to you?
It exhausts me. And again, much like my ADD, I've learned to manage it. You know, I do way better talking to people that are students or postdocs or that sort of thing is much less exhausting than talking to other faculty or in a position of authority. It's I need to like go for a walk immediately afterwards, almost. Yeah.
And so talking to students is easier.
I think it's easier in part because it's less about me and more about them. I don't like being the center of attention. If I'm helping someone, then it's not about me. Even in the context of like a division meeting when I was chair and I was running that, like it was exhausting just to sit in the room for an hour and try and orchestrate the meeting.
And I guess layering on imposter syndrome to that makes it doubly, triply hard.
Exactly. First of all, what the heck am I here for doing this? And then, oh my goodness, I have to actually do this. The whole COVID thing is terrible, obviously, but being able to work from home consistently has been really nice. And I can just not talk to anyone for as long as I can in between meetings.
That's like murder for me.
I know. This is...
As you can guess, I have very little experience with being an introvert. So.
I've taken lots of polls of students and over the years, and most at least epidemiologists that I've asked are introverts. A really good contrast is SER and Lisa versus Bill. Uh-huh. Right? Lisa's going to be quite content, very happy to organize the dance party. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that on the nights when there's not a dance party, you would be pretty happy finding some folks to go have a drink with or have dinner with or whatever. In contrast, Bill's going to either go back to his room and have room service. I'd go out by myself. Or if I'm really stretching it, I'll like go have dinner with a former student. So when I started on Twitter, I didn't join Twitter for Epi. I joined Twitter for the STD journal. And it was just surprising to me that people like cared what I had to say. Mm-hmm. And so when we got to SER last year and near then, there were clearly people that like were not getting the mentorship kinds of things that they needed. And so I'm like, well, that's something I can do. So if you want to talk to me, talk to me. And all of a sudden there was like this whole long list of people.
There was like a line. When I was sitting with you talking in the lobby, there was, you know, always like a lingering, like loitering student who was like, I'm next. There was a line of people.
I guess part of what motivates me is just, if that's helpful, then why not? And if I'm exhausted afterwards, then I don't have to talk to anybody else.
That sort of brings me to this question about Twitter. So a lot of really senior people don't engage on Twitter. They don't have an account, or they barely look at it, or they just look at it sometimes. And a lot of the times what I hear is like, I'm way too busy to do that. I know you are just as busy as all of these other people. And yet, you know, it feels like you are committed to being part of this community.
I joined Twitter for a very specific reason, which was the SCD Journal, which is what I'm the editor-in-chief for. We made a conscious decision to increase our Twitter presence. And then once I got on Twitter, I lurked for 6 months. Then I discovered like Epi Twitter and recognized that I hadn't really seen the potential for positive social bonding among the group. And then I started seeing questions like, you know, I'm trying to write a K award and I don't know what to do. And I'm like, well, I've read more K awards than any human being should ever have to read. So
I'm not proud of that fact.
But I might be able to help you. Let me give you some ideas. And then all of a sudden people were like, that was great. Thank you. And I felt like I had something to contribute. And I consciously try to at least go on and see what's there and see if there's something that people have tweeted at me. Look for things where there's something I can contribute. People have always said that I'm quite approachable. Like establishing that approachability on Twitter, I sort of just learned that you kind of come through as yourself. And as a result, people would ask me stuff. I find it fun, you know, like I can be an introvert. I'm not actually talking to anyone. Isn't that kind of nice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and still like supporting them.
Being an introvert and being on this podcast feels like what?
Well, I know that after this podcast, I am going to go ride my Peloton and not talk to a soul, including my wife. In the moment, I don't feel uncomfortable, but I know that it's taking more energy than it's giving. Mm. I'm enjoying this, mm-hmm. but if I had my choice most days, I would not talk to like anyone other than my wife.
You said that you were nervous before this started, and you were very open about being nervous, which I appreciated so much, especially because when people come on, they think they're the only one that has ever been nervous. I was glad that you said that because, again, it's admitting our vulnerabilities is perfectly fine.
Yeah. I'm not the macho kind of person that doesn't want to talk about weaknesses. I've just learned that there are people that feel the way I feel or something similar, and they struggle with it because they think they're the only one, or that there's like really something wrong with them that they feel this way. The nervousness about this is sort of like public speaking, right? It's mm-hmm. kind of the same principle.
Yep. Except it probably will reach more people than yeah. giving a talk.
Yeah.
Okay. No fair enough. Pressure. No pressure.
Now I'm really nervous. but you know how, like, you're giving a talk. I'm sure you would be nervous beforehand, right?
I am insanely nervous anytime I give a scientific talk.
Right.
Totally. And my stomach hurts so much.
I think there are so many like PhD students that are like, I can't go into academia because I get so nervous before I have to talk in front of people. And so I figure like if I can say, well, I get nervous too, maybe that will help them realize that and normalize our vulnerabilities.
The other conversation you and I engaged in on Twitter with others was about asking questions at the end of a seminar or, you know, some type of talk, especially at a meeting when there are lots of people there. The thrust of the conversation was that a lot of us are very fearful about asking questions, you know, after a 10-minute talk. And I was so relieved that people I respected were talking about this and that we then started to like share some science on this about how certain people need more time to actually, you know, form a question, to process a question that, and we actually talked about the feelings that it brought up where it was like, I'm going to challenge myself to ask a question. And then I spend, you know, I spend 3 minutes trying to psych myself up to do this. And then my heart is racing. I'm worried that during the time that I was psyching myself up to answer this, I missed a question that was basically my question. And that, you know, then I doubt myself and I'm like, maybe this was in the talk already. And I'm going to ask a question that people are like, were you not even listening in a 10-minute talk? Like, of course that was there. And then when I get up there to talk, my voice is quivering and my face gets bright red. You know, if I were sitting with that person, I would feel perfectly fine asking a question, but in front of all of your peers, how frightening it is, it still scares me.
I think in my entire career, I've probably walked up after a talk and asked certainly less than 10 times a question. And not that I haven't had questions.
Yeah.
But I go through the same thing. Like, is this dumb? Or even if I'm very confident in what I have to say.
Yes.
Like my heart is still about 3 feet out of my chest, you know? Yes. I remember at SER the last time I went to there was something about misclassification. And
that was my session. Bill, this is what brought up the conversation at Twitter. Now I'm realizing this, is that you asked such a good question and then you wrote on Twitter, like, I asked this question and I was, I wanted to throw up.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's what I was going to say. Like, who am I? First of all, who am I to be asking this group a question? So there was the imposter. And then there was like, is it going to actually make sense when it comes out of my mouth? But I somehow I managed to do it.
You did. And I remember that it was such a good question. Of the 4-5 talks, no one brought up this issue. And it was like, of course, like Bill just had the smartest thing to say. And I remember when you posted on Twitter that it made you really nervous. I was completely shocked. You didn't give me like outwardly any signs that you were nervous.
Well, that's the thing. I've learned to manage that like outwardly. And part of that is managing introversion. Part of that is managing imposter syndrome. Like I can project this sense of calm pretty much at any time.
That's such a great skill. You're a cat guy.
I've had a cat pretty much my entire life. I'll tell you about my favorite cat ever. Well,
please.
I'll tell you about my two favorite cats, really. The first one is named Herman. His brother was Hector. Hector died an early death. But Herman stayed on for a long time. And Herman was a gigantic cat, probably weighed like 20 pounds. The sort of tragic part of the story is, so my brother and I slept on the second floor of our house, and there was a porch roof outside and a vine that went up by the porch roof. And the cat would routinely at night climb up the vine and in through our window to get inside in the middle of the night. So one night he did this, and it was early in the morning, and he plopped down on our floor and just started meowing in the awfulest meow that you've ever seen. And what had happened is his back leg had gotten caught in a rabbit trap, and he still managed to come home and climb up and make it in, but
with the rabbit trap on his leg,
he somehow gnawed his way out.
Oh.
Yeah, and the leg was, well, we don't have to go into those details.
But it looked bad.
It looked bad.
It looked bad.
And he got his leg the rest of the way amputated. Oh. So he was a three-legged cat, but he would chase dogs out of our yard. Like, and he was just like this big, like, I don't care. I have three legs. Like, you ain't coming in here. And then my other favorite cat was one that we had recently, and his name was actually Twitter.
Really?
Before Twitter was a thing, we had Twitter.
Maybe Twitter is named after your cat.
I think so. I think, and that's why I kind of had to do it.
Right.
Like I had to become, I had to join Twitter because I had Twitter first. He was the most, he was the chillest cat ever. He like, you could do anything to him. He sort of took after me pretty much.
Did he have imposter syndrome?
Probably.
Okay. Given where you were in high school, how did you decide to go to Princeton?
Unlike some of your guests, I did apply to more than one college.
I know. There are so many people.
I've applied to places where I was recruited to play football, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. But they were all like Ivies and that sort of thing. And it came down to Brown or Princeton. Mm-hmm. The night before that I had to decide, like I had to send in my decision, the Brown football coach called me up. But the entire time, he just kept telling me why I shouldn't go to Princeton. You know, they don't do this, they don't do that. And so what does any 18-year-old boy do when an adult tells them
not to do something? Yeah, you were like, dude, you just helped me make my decision.
I mean, I was so clueless. I didn't know what it meant, like what an Ivy League school meant. None of that had any valence for me, but some grown up telling me I shouldn't do it, like, okay.
What do you do outside of work to stay sane?
I bake a lot of bread. I know that you don't bake bread so much.
No, I don't.
I've been baking for a long time. Actually, I started baking sort of semi-seriously when I was in college. I make pies. I make pizza. I've made forever. I've made pizza on 3 continents.
That's a strange fact.
It is, isn't it?
Which continents?
Africa, South America, and North America. Like with pizza, I make the crust. I make the sauce. I don't make the cheese.
Did you say I don't make the cheese? I'm glad you clarified
that. But you know what?
I would have been like, I assume he makes the cheese too.
My daughter spent all day yesterday making cheese at her apartment in North Carolina.
So you remember Jill Reedy, right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. She always tells a story about visiting a cheese factory. Is that what it's called? I don't know. Where you make cheese?
Yeah.
Like a, you know, like a industrial cheese factory. And that, you know, you got to like churn the cheese. And that, I mean, this was a long time ago. And there was a man who stood in the vat of cheese and he would turn it like his arms out. Like he was, you know, like a turnstile himself. And she said, like, he was wearing, maybe he had like no shirt on or he had like a tank top on. And she would say that he, like, she could see his like hairy armpits like in the cheese.
May not ever eat cheese again.
Right. And like that ruined cheese for a long time for her. And so when you said that your daughter was making cheese, like the first thing I thought of was like,
I have photographic evidence that she was not standing. Okay.
That's a lot of cheese.
That's a lot of cheese, yeah.
To stand in it. If you could choose to be an Olympic athlete, at the snap of your fingers, what would be your sport?
Wow, there's so many.
Really? What are the top three?
I don't really think of this as an Olympic sport, but I would say baseball first because it is an Olympic sport nowadays.
When did you stop playing baseball as a kid?
The end of college. I played all.
Oh, you played in college?
Yeah.
Bill, I had no idea that you were this like crazy good athlete. So that's number one. What are the other couple sports you'd play?
I'd be a sprinter. I ran indoor track in high school, the 60-yard dash, which is as short as you can run over a race. Yeah. And I think as a kid, I would have said like the long jump.
Oh, that's so hard.
Yeah, but it's kind of cool. You know, you like sprint down the thing and then get all covered in sand. Isn't that done?
That's true. That seems on brand, actually. Yeah.
But as an aside, I did have my elementary school standing long jump record for several years.
What was it?
I don't remember. But to be completely open about this,
Yeah. Yes, please.
I'm in my high school's Hall of Fame. It's actually technically called the Wall of Fame, but yeah.
Okay, listeners, all this stuff about imposter syndrome is totally a lie. Bill Miller is here to brag about his
Wall of Fame.
Why were you on the Wall of Fame?
For football and baseball.
Were you like record setting and?
Well, I was like all league multiple times and stuff like that.
Oh, were you all American?
I was all state.
Nice. First team?
Second team, all state.
Okay. Well, you should have said that.
Yeah, sorry. Depends on which all state, actually.
Oh, excuse me. Oh my gosh. I just thought you were this like sweet, smart, like nerdy guy. Did you go to college and play football and play baseball?
I played football for my first year and I played baseball 4 years. Yeah. It was a huge decision not to play football my sophomore year. I was just like really deeply worried I was going to disappoint people. And I, you know, the call, making that phone call to the coach that I wasn't going to play, like I was so anxious. And they were like, okay.
We can fill that seat with someone.
Exactly.
Thanks, Bill.
You're welcome. That's just fun. We never said hello like you normally do in your...
Oh, yeah. Should we do that now?
Should we do that for you?
Yeah. Okay. Hi, Bill. I was going to keep a straight face. It was you that screwed it up.
I know. Maybe you should just use that.